This is text for audiobook in MP3 of Dion Fortune's book, Through the Gates of Death. The Great Anesthetist. Note, anesthetists are doctors who have completed a full medical training. As graduate doctors, they choose to complete further training to become an anesthetist. Death is a universal experience. No one can hope to escape. It is only a matter of time till it comes to each one of us and each one of those we love. Yet death is called the king of terrors and is the supreme threat of the law to the wrongdoer. What is it that makes a natural process so terrible? Is it the pain of dying? No, for anodynes can deaden that. Most deathbeds are peaceful when the time comes, and few souls go out struggling. What, then, is it we fear in death that it should be for us a thing of grief and dread? Firstly, we fear the unknown. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil? Secondly, we dread the separation from those we love. These are the things which make death terrible. How differently should we set out to cross the threshold, were our minds at rest on these two points? It is recorded that the great gift of the Greek mysteries to their initiates was rela assay from the fear of death. It is said that no initiate ever fears death. What was it that was taught in those secret rites that robbed death of its terrors? In the center of the great pyramid of Gizeh there is an empty stone coffin. Egyptologists tell us that it was prepared for a pharaoh who never occupied it. It has also been said that it was a measure for Kom. It was neither of these things, but the altar of the chamber of initiation. In it lay the candidate while his soul was sent out upon the journey of death and recalled, and this constituted the supreme degree of the mysteries. After that experience he never feared death again. Time knew what it was. It is the knowledge guarded in the mysteries which I propose to reveal in these pages. Death, for the man who has this knowledge, is like the embarkation of the rich man upon a liner. He is educated, he knows where he is going, he acquiesces in the journey, realizing its necessity and advantages. His knowledge and resources enable him to travel in comfort and safety. He can keep in touch with his friends at will, and return to them when he desires. For him there is no final and complete severance from his native land. Far otherwise is it with the poor peasant emigrant. Ignorant and helpless, the journey to him is a dangerous and hazardous undertaking, and the land of his sojourn may be filled with wild beasts or undermined with volcanic fires. His ignorant imagination pictures all the terrors he can conceive and applies them to the unknown. The ancient Egyptians placed in every coffin a so-called Book of the Dead, the ritual of Osiris in the underworld, which instructed the soul concerning its journey through the kingdoms of the shades. It might more truly be called the Book of the Ever-Living, for the soul was conceived of as going through certain stages in that cycle of life which takes place in the unseen. 9. It would be well for us were we taught from our earliest years to think of our lives as rising and falling like a boat on the crest of a wave. Now descending into matter through the gates of birth, now reascending to the invisible world through the gates of death, ever and anon to return again and withdraw again in the rhythmical cyclic tide of evolving life. Uninstructed by the mysteries, our lives abounded by the horror of birth and the terror of death. How great is the gift of the guarded wisdom which reveals the road of evolving life stretching before our feet and robs the unseen of its shadows. Let us cease to think of death as the fury with the abhorred shears and conceive of it as the great anesthetist, bidden by the mercy of God to cause a deep sleep to fall upon us while the silver cord is loosed and the soul set free. From that sleep we awake refreshed, with the problems of earth far behind us, like a young child's memories of the previous day, and embark upon a fresh phase of our existence. Well is it for us if our friends give us quittance and permit the soul to go free to its own place. Ill is it for us if the grief of those we have left behind shadows that bright morning waking. Just as we feel that we have the right to ask for tendance in our sickness from those who are kin to us, so should we feel that we have the right to ask of them fortitude in their bereavement. For it is their bereavement, not ours. Whom do we grieve for when we mourn at a funeral? For the ever-living dead, in their bright awakening? Or for ourselves in our loneliness? Assuredly we grieve for no one but ourselves, for it is well with the dead, they have gone to their own place and are at peace. 10. It is those who are left behind who are suffering, not those who have gone before us into Galilee. And what shall we say concerning their suffering? That like all pain, it must be bravely borne, and especially so in this case, for its reverberations may affect others as well as ourselves, and be as a millstone about the neck of the soul that is seeking to rise up on the strong wings of aspiration. Let thoughts of love, not grief, follow that soul upon its journey, as seagulls follow a ship. Let us bid him Godspeed and good cheer, and look forward to the reunion. For there is much we can do for the departed. Our work is not finished when the coffin is borne from the house and we have put away the sad paraphernalia of illness. If they know more than we do of the ancient, guarded, secret wisdom, it may well be that they will return to comfort us and give us good counsel. But if we know more than they do, if the soul has gone out in bewilderment and fear, or if it be that of a young child, then it is our bounden duty to follow it out into the unseen as far as lies in our power, until we feel the coming of the angels, of which more shall be said later, and know that our loved one has passed into their care and all is well. And there may come to us, if we ask, that angel which giveth the beloved sleep, the deep sleep which is well known to fall upon the watchers of the dead and which is like no other sleep, and from that sleep we too should awaken to the morning calm, for it has been permitted to us to look through the gates ajar and see that beyond the threshold there is neither terror nor oblivion, but another world, another phase of life. Out of this sleep which the angel of death giveth to the beloved there cometh security and assurance, for we have seen, even if we do not remember. Let us, therefore, when the hour is over, ask of the greater niece that is this lesser mercy that we may be tided over the first wrench of the separation and be the better enabled to take up the burden of life and do our duty to those loved ones that are left to us, depending upon us and needing us. And let us, above all things, never forget that in due course the dead will come back, and we never know when we shall see looking out at us from the eyes of a little child a soul we have known. Let us therefore, seeking expression for the love that now has no earthly outlet, turn it to the endeavor to make the world a better place for the return of those we love. This service at least we can do them, that no repining of ours shall make bitter their journey, and that as far as lies in our power, the rough places of the world shall be made smooth against their return. Chapter 2. Crossing the Threshold. When all that medical science can do has been exhausted, those who stand in the death chamber awaiting the end are filled with an overwhelming sense of impotence. They have the desire to help, but the total inability to find any adequate practical expression thereof. The consolations of religion may comfort those to whom the spiritual life is a reality, but for many it is no more than a vague hope, and for some, a negation. Have we anything to offer to these? Yes, we have. We can offer them knowledge. Knowledge derived from the experience of many, many souls who have crossed the great gulf and returned to tell us of their adventures, and also from the experiences of those others, fewer, perhaps, but for us more convincing, who can remember their past lives. In Europe they are rarely to be met with among adults, but many children, before the shades of the prison house of worldly things close about them, can give us memories of past lives if we ask wisely. In the East such memories are common, being the rule rather than the exception. This knowledge concerning the hidden life of the soul can not only give courage and comfort to the doubting, but be the means of actively helping those who are passing over. We need no longer stand with empty hands at the bedside of the dying. Though our hands may find nothing more to do, our minds should be active, and we should be making ourselves ready to accompany our friends on the first stage of their journey. We can literally set them on their way as we would do with the parting guest. But before we can consider exactly what may be done for the departing, we must first understand the process of the putting off of the flesh. There are two kinds of death, natural death and violent death. And there are also two kinds of passing, the peaceful passing, which is normal, and the unpeaceful one, which is pathological. For dying is no less a natural process than being born, and has its norm and its pathologies. Natural death is that which takes place gradually, the soul loosening itself from the body before its departure, just as a child's milk teeth become loose in the socket and fall out painlessly. Violent death, however, is like the pulling of a tooth by the dentist. There is a wrench, a shock, and some bleeding and soreness. Normally, however, the great anaesthetist gets in his work rapidly, and with the first opening of the line of cleavage between soul and body, the greater sleep descends upon us and we know no more. Where, however, there is much fear of death, or a desperate clinging to life, the work of the great anaesthetist is frustrated, and then are seen those terrible deathbeds when the soul goes out struggling. This should never take place, and need never take place where there is adequate knowledge of the processes of death and the after-death life. The dying man should surrender himself into the hands of the merciful angel with the same confidence and gratitude that he would submit to the offices of the physician who is giving the anesthetic that is going to shield his consciousness from the work of the surgeon. As soon as the ether gets in its merciful work, the pain and fear will fade and he will sleep for a while, knowing nothing. And so it is with death. The dark angel closes one by one the avenues of consciousness, and we sleep within ourselves while the processes of the separation of body and soul go on. When all is over, then we are freed from the body. The angel will reopen the gates of awareness upon a higher plane, and we shall live again, though in another dimension. We may find it difficult to realize the kind of life to which we shall open our eyes as the day dawns once more, but we may rest assured that when we awaken on the next life, it will appear to us as normal and natural as the earth life to which we are accustomed, because we shall find that we are adapted to it. The soul that goes to meet death with understanding, invoking the merciful offices of the great angel and welcoming his healing ministrations, will draw out from the bourne of time and space as quietly and steadily as a great ship putting to sea. The changes come gradually, there is no shock or surprise, and as one sure fades, the further one begins to rise above the skyline. Insensibly we have drawn away from the body without noticing it. The lower consciousness is now deeply anesthetized. The higher consciousness is opening, and we find ourselves in what has been called by various names, but which we will call the body of light. This is not the same thing as the etheric double, or subtle, magnetic aspect of the physical body. It is this which is anesthetized by the great angel, for it is in this that the physical processes of death go on, but we know nothing about them, any more than we know of the operation that is performed upon us while we are under chloroform. It is not everyone, however, who falls into a deep sleep when passing through the gates of death. Souls with any degree of psychic development pass out in full consciousness. For although the physical body lapses into insensibility, we should not take it for granted that the soul is unconscious. Anyone who has had experience of trance knows that this is not necessarily so, and that consciousness can be transferred from the body to the soul and retained unimpaired. It is this which happens in death. The consciousness is transferred from the body to the soul, and the soul departs to its own place on the inner planes, taking the consciousness with it. It may be wondered whether the soul will not be lonely and forlorn when it first arrives in the heaven world, but all who have returned to tell us about the pathway of death, and they are very many, agree that this is not the case. The heaven world appears familiar to the newcomer, and for this reason, we are all accustomed to go there in sleep every night. There is a sleep life of the soul of which the average person is unaware, because he does not bring back the memory upon waking. It is beyond the realm of dream, which is purely subconscious, and the soul of little psychic development remains sound asleep while out of the body, or at best, drowsy and difficult to rouse. It is the rousing of the soul to consciousness upon this plane which produces the dreams, which are not like ordinary dreams, of which many people have had experience. The psychically developed person is at a great advantage when it comes to passing through the gates of death, for he goes over in full consciousness. He does not sleep the sleep of death, he merely loses consciousness of the physical plane while retaining all his faculties. Anyone who has ever experienced trance with retained memory, or a lucid dream, has died and risen again, and he will find that death is exactly the same. But although the heaven world will not prove to be unfamiliar to us, seeming rather like the home of early childhood revisited, we are nevertheless not left comfortless. There is organized charity in the next world just as there is here, and there are disembodied souls who give themselves to the work of receiving and ministering to the newcomers, companioning them until they feel at home. It is well known how often dying people exclaim that they see a great light, and in that light are the faces of friends and relatives who have passed out before them. Whenever there is a strong bond of love between souls on different sides of the gulf of death, those on the far side invariably come down to the shore to welcome the newcomer upon his arrival. It is a great thing to know that as the physical world recedes from us, the coast of the next world is rising above the horizon of consciousness, and on that shore will be awaiting our coming all those who have loved us and who have gone before us into the unseen. We shall land amid familiar faces, as the last words of many a passing soul, calling a greeting, give evidence. But what of those who have no close ties with any in the next world? Are they left comfortless? No, indeed. They will be met by those who knew unrequited love while on earth, and who had given to the service of all the love which was not needed by the one. The come to meet the friendless ones, those who have in their own lives achieved the ideals, however dimly realized and rarely glimpsed, which appeal to each soul as the noblest goal of life, and by their help the soul goes forward to its lessons and its achievements. Chapter 3. Helping or hindering the dead. The question of communication with the departed has always been a vexed one. On the one hand, we have those who deny its possibility and say that all so-called communications are either fraud, delusion, or credulity. On the other are those who admit the possibility of traffic with the dead, but call it necromancy and condemn it unsparingly. Meanwhile, those who have lost dear ones have recourse in rapidly increasing numbers to mediums who act, or claim to act, as psychic telephones between this world and the next. It is agreed by those who have extended experience in the matter, that although communication with the departed is by no means universally to be condemned, it needs to be approached with caution under carefully chosen conditions, and a state of extreme grief and desperate emotional upheaval is certainly not the ideal condition under which an approach should be made. Sometimes the state of mind of the bereaved is such that it is advisable for the dead to return to give the desired assurance, but to do so is an act of self-sacrifice on their part, and nothing can possibly be worse for the departing soul than to be called back repeatedly to communicate with those left behind. To hold the soul to physical life in this way is an act of great, though no doubt unintentional selfishness. It disturbs their one who has entered into the light, and prevents him from settling down in his new conditions. It is just as if a fond mother placed her child at a boarding school, and then kept on sending for him and weeping over her loneliness and lamenting the parting. What would be the state of mind of a child who was treated like that? He would get no pleasure from his new companions and his sports, nor profit from his lessons. If we keep on calling the departed back to us through the instrumentality of a medium, are acting just as unwisely and selfishly as the foolish mother. As soon as this life ends, the next life begins, and the dead have their own work to do. We must be content to let them do it freely and in their own way, just as a woman, however loving and beloved, must be content to let her husband or son go forth to do their work in the world. It is noticeable in the communications received from the departed that the newly dead are fairly accessible to communication, and then, after a while, they seem to go on to a further plane where communication ceases to be possible. If we keep on calling them back, they cannot make this transition and become earthbound. The process of death is incomplete, and they cannot enter into their rest. While therefore it may be justifiable, or even advisable, to re-establish communication with those who have just passed over, it is in every way undesirable to keep up this communication unduly. It should be enough for us that those who have passed out send us word of their safe arrival upon the other shore. Having received that, we ought to rest content. The state into which the dead enter immediately after departure is an intermediate and transitional, and it is one in which certain definite post-mortem pathologies can occur. Cases in which all has not gone well are delayed there, awaiting the working out of their problems. Normally, the soul passes swiftly through this phase and leaves it behind. Delay at this stage is very undesirable. The soul should be speeded on its journey, and it is for this purpose that the Catholic Church says Mass is for the dead. These Masses are of great value, and the principle should be reintroduced into the liturgies of all faiths. We should not think that we have rendered the last office to the dead when the funeral service has been said over them, but the consolations of religion should follow them right through this transition stage until they are well established in their new life. As long as any shreds of earth ties linger, the protection and guidance of organized religion should be available to the soul. This intermediate stage between life and death is not the same thing as purgatory. It is rather an ending stage whereon the soul steps ashore and gathers together its baggage and greets its friends. Purgatory might be defined as a psychic quarantine. It is only after consciousness has accustomed itself to the disembodied life that the soul goes on to face the purification of purgatory. Let it be clearly realized that purgatory is not punitive, nor is it eternal, but consists in forcing the soul to face its own record. It is the reactions of the soul to that record which are the cleansing fires. Purgatory is not a place, but a state of consciousness, but because, on the inner planes, all those with the same outlook draw together, purgatory for all practical psychic purposes has a definite astral location. It is while souls are going through their purgatory that the threads of communication with this world are severed. Each soul must enter into the silence in order to pass through the cleansing fires. No one can help them there. They must stand upon their own feet and walk by such light as they have. Not otherwise can they learn their lessons. We can no more learn for another than we can eat for another. We must surrender our loved ones into the hands of the Lords of Karma when this point is reached. We have this comfort, however, that it is their aim to make, not to break the soul, and no one is given more than they can bear, nor even more than they can assimilate and turn to good use. The esotericist would not agree with the Catholic teaching that Masses for the dead can help a soul in purgatory. He holds that the value of the prayers of priest and friends is in the influence they have upon the soul during the intermediary period. Once the soul has passed through this phase, it finds its place in the great cycle of life on the inner planes and will be cared for. After the soul has drawn clear of purgatory, it is not only possible but legitimate to re-establish communication with it, provided the right methods are used. If we are able to raise consciousness to the higher psychic planes, we can of our own volition come into telepathic touch with the departed and hear their voice with the inner ear. It is not advisable to try and see them with psychic vision, because this belongs to a lower subplane of the astral for that upon which the blessed departed, cleansed from their sins, are privileged to abide. Clairaudience is the right method to use in communication with those who have passed to the heaven world. It will be noticeable that descriptions of the heaven world are nearly always second-hand. The psychic is told what that world is like, but does not actually see it. There are, of course, exceptions to this general rule in the case of exceptionally gifted psychics, or exceptional circumstances, but generally speaking it will be found to hold good, and we may know that if we see the departed with psychic vision, they are still in the intermediate world, and that when they have arrived safely in the heaven world we shall hear but not see them when they attempt direct communication. When we are trying to get into touch with them, therefore, we should listen, but not look, and in the still small voice of the inner consciousness we may not unreasonably expect to hear at least a word of greeting. Once contact is established, there will be times when we shall get a distinct impression of a need so tangible that we feel we have only to reach out the hand to touch it. But if we open our eyes we shall find nothing there. The dead, upon their plane, are minds without bodies, and when they speak to our mental, and not to our bodily senses. That is to say, it is the intuition that perceives them, and not the sight. It is good that normal, Intuitional communication could be established between the dead and the living, for it robs death of its terrors. We ought to look upon the dead as living in another state of consciousness, not another place. If we can tune into their vibration, we can hear them and speak to them. In fact, we can speak to them much more readily than we can hear them, for the dead, being bodiless, are normally psychic. It is for this reason that we should guard our thoughts carefully in relation to the dead, and especially strive to overcome our grief and learn to acquiesce in their departure. Our attitude towards the dead should be the same as it would if they had set out to seek their fortunes overseas. We would send to an emigrating son or lover a word of good cheer to hearten him in his distant enterprise. If we continually sent a tale of woe, enlarging on our own sufferings in his absence, could we expect our letters to be eagerly welcomed? Would they not rather be dreaded as an ordeal? What should be our aim? To help and encourage and hearten the dead, or to indulge our own grief and relieve our feelings at their expense? The parting and the loneliness, the loss of the breadwinner and protector, or the lifelong companion, are indeed a grief, but a grief to be bravely borne in order that our darkness may not overshadow the beloved one. We ought to accept our lot cheerfully so that they may be free to go through the great experiences of the soul and enter into their rest with a quiet mind. Chapter 4. The Overcoming of Grief. The way in which we face bereavement is one of the greatest tests of our spiritual understanding. Our attitude towards the death of the body, whether our own or that of one dear to us, depends upon what we really believe life to be. Do we, in our hearts, look upon the physical body as the real man, and all it means to us upon the physical plane is constituting our relationship with the soul we love, incarnated in that body? Then how can we do otherwise than lament our irreparable loss when death breaks the frail vessel that holds our loved one? But do we actually know, from our experience of inner things, that man is a spiritual being, eternal and immortal? Then we shall be able to look beyond the death of the body to the eye that is hid with Christ in God. There is more than one kind of love, and bereavement will reveal which kind is ours. The lowest kind of love is more of a hunger than anything else. We hunger for affection and care and attention, suddenly thrown upon our own resources by bereavement. We feel the pangs of emotional starvation. Another kind of love, and one that is not so very much higher than the obviously selfish kind, relieves an emotional tension by pouring out demonstrative affection and service upon the beloved one, without stopping to inquire too closely what his needs may be. This kind of love, suddenly denied its outlet and thrown back upon itself, shakes the nature to its foundations and is responsible for many breakdowns after bereavement. P.26. It may seem a strange thing to say, but true love is hot emotional in its nature, but is an attitude of the soul towards life. True love is a spiritual radiation, like sunlight, and like the sun, it shines upon the evil and the good, the just and the unjust, not blind to their condition, but loving them just the same. This is the noblest love, and it has healing in its wings. True love proceeds from a loving nature, not from stimulated emotions. It is the only kind which will make for happiness in marriage or any other relation of life, and it is not this kind of love that leads to mental breakdowns and extremities of grief when the beloved one is removed by death. It is true there must always be shock and emptiness when one upon whose love we have leant for years is taken from us, for the whole life must be readjusted, but the shock should not be of such a nature as to bring the whole structure of existence crashing down. If it does this, we may know that we have broken the second commandment. We have made a graven image and worshipped it, instead of knowing and serving the one true God. There can be but one true center of life, and that is God. We may have companions and dear comrades upon the path of life, but life itself has only one center. If the hub of a wheel is anywhere save in the exact center, the wheel is out of the true, and useless. We and our loved ones are like spokes in the wheel of life, but for both them and us the hub should be God. When we try to throw the weight of our life upon one spoke, instead of upon the hub, we are making a radical mistake, a mistake that throws us out of balance upon all planes. If we and those we love are God-centered, death will bring no sense of inner isolation, for we shall know that they have gone on ahead of us to the goal at which we were mutually aiming.